Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Council on Foreign Relations Africa in Transition podcast. My name is John Campbell, and I'm here with Edward Callan, UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Nigeria, and Peter Lundberg, Deputy UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Nigeria. They are currently in Washington, D.C., where they have been briefing Congress and the executive branch of government on the unfolding humanitarian crisis in northeastern Nigeria. Gentlemen, we have a lot to talk about. Let's start with what the actual situation is on the ground. To what extent in northeastern Nigeria has the security situation been restored to the point where humanitarian agencies can operate?
We are dealing with a crisis of global magnitude in northeast Nigeria, which is also a crisis of global magnitude from a security perspective. The security situation is improving gradually. More areas are being liberated by the Nigerian army, but access to pockets of the enclaves still occupied by Boko Haram is still a constraint faced by the international humanitarian partners to reach the affected population. There is still a huge number of people that we don't have access to. As we speak today, an estimated 8.5 million people need urgent humanitarian assistance in the three epicenters of the crisis in northeast Nigeria. That is Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states. The worrisome trend we are dealing with is that 450,000 children are severely malnourished, and an estimated 4.7 million people need urgent humanitarian assistance.
I saw an estimate that there were an estimated 700,000 internally displaced persons that, in fact, humanitarian agencies could not reach because of the security situation. Does that strike you as approximately right?
That is an estimated figure that is currently used, but it is an estimate that is derived from the population that existed in this area. We are not very sure about mm-hmm. this number, but the mm-hmm. estimate is that up to 700,000 people might be still locked in areas that are controlled by Boko Haram as we speak.
So, we have at least three different groups. We have the 400,000 children that are faced with famine, the up to 700,000 that humanitarian agencies cannot reach, 4.5 million people who need food, and a total of a bit more than 8 million people who need humanitarian assistance of one sort or another. Do I have that right?
Correct.
This, as you say, is a humanitarian crisis of world historical importance. How would you characterize the international community's response to it?
We have moved through phases in appreciation of the scale and scope of the crisis in northeast Nigeria. We have moved from a phase of complete denial mm-hmm. to a phase of realization by the government of Nigeria of a humanitarian crisis and the need for humanitarian assistance to address the impact of the Boko Haram crisis. Likewise, the international awareness on the impact of the Boko Haram crisis has been raised recently through two opportunities. One was the Oslo Pledging Conference that took place in February in Norway. At this conference, the international community came together to look and assess the impact of the humanitarian crisis in Northeast Nigeria and the Lake Chad Basin region, and pledge generously $458 million to address the humanitarian needs in 2017. At this conference, the international community agreed on the need for a holistic approach to address the immediate humanitarian life-saving needs of the affected population, but also look at the short, medium, long-term needs in a holistic manner to address the root causes of this crisis. The second most recent opportunity was the visit of the Security Council to Nigeria and the Lake Chad, and countries in the Lake Chad region. On return of the Security Council to New York, a resolution was passed on Boko Haram and the countries in the Lake Chad region. This was the first United Nations Security Council resolution on the Boko Haram crisis in Nigeria and the Lake Chad region. The resolution was very emphatic on the effort that has been made by the government and the Nigerian army, and also the multinational joint task force. The resolution also called on the international community to provide humanitarian assistance to save lives of the affected population. It was also endorsed the efforts of the international humanitarian partners to scale up assistance was also endorsed. But there was a clear realization that more needs to be done to prevent a famine situation. And the resolution also called for a holistic approach to try to address the root causes of this crisis while meeting the immediate needs. So this was an opportunity to raise awareness on the impact of the Boko Haram crisis, which before this time was virtually in the back burner.
It was indeed. Some of us have been writing about it for some time and have been distressed by the lack of response. Turning to the Oslo conference briefly, I believe that the UN asked for about $1.6 billion or so. Is that correct?
$1 billion. $1.05 billion.
For Nigeria.
For Nigeria alone.
Alone.
But 1.5, 1.6 for the Nigeria whole and the Lake Chad region together.
And the donors pledged about a quarter of that amount.
Is that correct? Yeah.
And some notable donors, I'm thinking specifically of the United States, pledged no new money. Is that correct?
We have to put it in context. The U.S. government has been one of the biggest donors to the crisis. They have contributed well over $100 million to address the humanitarian needs in Northeast Nigeria. They did not make a pledge during the Oslo conference, but they have been a very important contributor to the crisis.
They have been a very important contributor to the crisis in the past.
Yes.
The question is whether they will continue to do so. And at Oslo, they pledged no new money. At least that's my understanding.
Yes, I mean, the people of America have been very generous in addressing humanitarian needs around the globe.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And Nigeria is one of the countries that we are highlighted by our new Secretary General that needed international support to prevent a famine happening. So I am very positive that the government of the government of the U.S. of the United States will contribute some resources to help save lives in these famine-affected countries, and I'm also very hopeful that Nigeria will be a beneficiary from such contribution, which we are made to understand will be voted on in the next few days as we speak.
Voted on by the Congress?
Yes, as we speak.
I am sure that if the Congress votes such assistance, that in all probability the lion's share of it will go to Nigeria, simply because that's where the greatest need is in terms of numbers of people.
In terms of numbers of people, I mean, you have other affected areas, but indeed the numbers in Nigeria are big.
It's a huge country.
It's a huge country also, dealing with it from that perspective.
Of the pledges made at Oslo, are donors paying towards what they pledged?
It has been very slow. At best, we have described it as trickling in.
Trickling in, yes. Mm-hmm.
Since the Oslo conference. And that is one of the reasons why we are out here reaching out to member states.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to one, confirm their pledges, and two, disburse it as soon as possible. We are dealing with a very tough reality in Northeast Nigeria, and time is not on our side.
No.
We have been able to scale up humanitarian assistance substantially. For example, the World Food Program scaled up assistance from October by over 700% as we speak, from 159,000 people assisted in October to over 1 million people that are currently being assisted. Our biggest worries is that if we don't have the resources to sustain this assistance, the situation can relapse into a famine situation.
Yes.
And we are already extremely stressed because 43,000 people are currently in a famine-like situation. So that is the urgency we're talking about.
Your estimate is that there are 43,000 currently in famine.
In a famine-like situation.
Right, right. People who are literally starving to death.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the big concern is that there is approximately 1.4 million people who is one step away from getting into a famine-like condition
right.
as well.
So if you take those who are actually in famine and those for whom famine is an immediate threat, you're talking about almost 2 million people.
We talk about 1.4 plus 43,000.
Oh, plus 43,000.
Plus
okay, 43, so 1 million 000. And a half. Women and children, the principal victims?
Indeed, they are the primary victims of this awkward, hopeless, and senseless crisis, and they have been disproportionately affected. The figures are appalling from all perspective. I have been doing this for many, many years,
yes,
but I have never, never come across the scale and scope of sexual gender-based violence that we are talking about in Northeast Nigeria. Over 7,000 women, boys, and girls have reported sexual gender-based violence since the start of this crisis. 69 children, women, boys, and girls have been used as human bombs.
Yes.
Yeah, to attack displaced camps and also humanitarian distribution sites. There are widespread reports of sexual exploitation because of the breakdown of traditional safety nets.
Yes.
As a result of the crisis moving ahead. Violations of the rights of children is also a major concern. The statistics are also appalling. An estimated 8,000 children, boys, girls, and women have been used by Boko Haram since the crisis in 2009 to date. Over 4,000 children have been killed and over 3,000 have been maimed. This is the dimension of the protection concerns we are dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, we have conceptualized the crisis in Northeast Nigeria as a protection and a food security and nutrition crisis.
The international awareness of the food security and nutritional dimensions, I think, is growing. I'm not sure the international community has focused on the gender-based violence dimension to the same extent.
I think my deputy humanitarian coordinator, who actually sits in Maiduguri, we shed some light to the American audience on the protection dimensions we are talking about and the risk we are facing here. Indeed, more needs to be done. The protection component is the least funded in the 2017 humanitarian response plan. And our call is that this element remains extremely critical. because these are the vulnerable groups that have been, that are suffering from these gross violations. But I will hand over to Peter to give you a practical reflection on the protection concern as we deal with in Northeast Nigeria. Over to you, Peter.
So that's correct. It is actually a protection crisis at the onset, and the food security issues that's coming as a follow to the lack of taking people's protection needs into full consideration, and the protection sector, which is dealing over with the whole, from the whole international community on protection needs, is only covered to about 12% according to our latest figures that we are getting in. So it's a serious issue, because if you want to scale up the assistance to people who are internally displaced, these are the ones that are first and foremost suffering and facing insecurity. The majority of the internally displaced people in the Northeast are living with host communities.
Yes.
But about 25-30% are living in formal or informal
camps.
Yeah. IDP camps. We have, from the United Nations side, together with our international partners, recently launched a network on prevention of sexual exploitation and abuse. And we have also raised our voice and in close discussion also with the Nigerian authorities, because this is ultimately also their main responsibility to respond to protection needs that arises across these three main affected states in the Northeast. And we're also happy to note that the state authorities have taken measures, bringing in, for instance, female undercover police to work in the camps, and there has also been arrests made from perpetrators, and there are due process in place. But of course, more needs to be done. The biggest challenge for us to expand on our protection work is access. Access in the way to reach very hard to reach places, because the insecurity in this environment is very high.
Yes.
And we also have to take our the safety of our workers at the highest consideration. When we travel, normally one would travel with a car, but in this case we have to travel with helicopters because of the level of insecurity on the ground. So we have a number of locations where we have camps and where we work with the displaced people and host communities in various parts, especially in Borno State. So people from our side, they have to travel to these locations and they have to spend quality time on the ground. It was just very recently, I was in one of the local government areas in the Northeast. The place is called Dikwa.
Yes.
You mentioned those 700,000 people that are living in very hard to reach places where we, for security reasons, are not able to access. Mm-hmm. But people are also trickling out from these locations, moving into the urban centers where they are hoping to get relief and assistance. We can see there is an increased flow of people coming out from these very remote villages. And just a couple of weeks ago, I was in Dikwa and I met a whole group of people, about 300, who had walked for almost 2 days. And this is a very hot part of the world.
Yes.
This was mainly elderly men and women and very young children, because the younger men and women were held back and they were not allowed to leave. So I met a woman who told us that she had just lost her four daughters who were not allowed to pass to get into Dikwa and to get to the assistance that is now being provided more and more in these places. I mean, we can actually see the effect of the scale-up also in these very remote locations across the Northeast. But the assistance is there, but for these people to actually come out, it's very, very difficult. I also met with a gentleman in another location in Pulka at the same period. He told me the story that he had been living in remote villages where Boko Haram was moving around. And one day they came to his village and were asking mainly for food, for water, and also to recruit more people. And
so they're still actively recruiting.
That's the story he told me. And the communities in this location was so having so difficult times even to cope for themselves.
Yes.
This is a part of Northeast Nigeria where the agriculture sector have not been able to work effectively for the last 3 years due to the conflict. So this is where the driving force for the potential famine is coming from. Majority of the people, like this gentleman who I met, are farmers, and they simply cannot go and do the traditional farming because of the high level of insecurity. So they did not have anything to provide. So immediately several of his neighbors were executed, and he was publicly whipped. And during the night, he and some of his family members managed to flee and went down to Pulka, where they reached the IOM, International Organization for Migrations, camp for internally displaced people. And that's where I met him, and I heard the story that he told me.
But in the case of the large group that you met with, elderly men, women, and children, and where younger men and women were held back, that would imply that Boko Haram in that particular area was strong enough that it could hold a population and push out a population that basically cannot fight or be productive.
I think what's happening is that as the Nigerian army, together with the multinational joint task force, is making advances and moving in, this is where these communities are then given an opportunity to basically stand up and leave, and leave towards this this safer urban local government areas, which is across the whole north, in many more locations that was there only a year or 2 years ago. But it's true that there is not full control. And when these operations are over and done with, we can see how Boko Haram is also coming back and it's...
You mean reestablishing itself?
In a way or so.
Maiduguri's population, some people say, has doubled.
It doubled, but then we can also see that it's actually reducing because there is a migration flow where people who has been displaced in Maiduguri for a long time has also started to move towards home. The problem is that many of these people get stuck on the way back home.
They don't get all the way
home. They don't get all the way home, so they get into what we would then call a secondary displacement. So they were displaced. Many of these communities has already been displaced several times over the years. So a large inflow 2015 to Maiduguri, where the population approximately went from 1 to almost 2 million people, has now been reduced. But that means that a lot of those people that have started to return has gone back to the LGA capitals, the local government area capitals. But they are probably from other villages outside. And these are those locations that they still can't access. Mm-hmm. So they end up being in Dikwa or Bama or Monguno. Mm-hmm. And that's where also our assistance, which from the beginning was very much focused on Maiduguri, for instance, has to go and move with these populations as these populations move. Then we have another challenging situation, and that is the people that fled across international borders, and the majority of those fled into Cameroon. And we are very concerned that there has been a forced push of some of these refugees
back across the border
into Nigeria. And this is something that we from the United Nations have raised at the very highest level, also with the Cameroonian authorities. There was a tripartite agreement signed as late as March this year, which should coordinate movement of people based on safety, dignity, and voluntarism across both within the countries, but also across international borders. And we can see that this agreement is now being violated, and this is something we are raising with the Cameroonian authorities at the very highest level to ensure the protection needs of these refugees are taken into full consideration.
So there is an immediate crisis related to food and gender-based violence. And there, the time is short. Otherwise, the number who are in a famine situation will increase rapidly. And that is where, in the short term, the international community's focus must be. But then there is the longer term question. The traditional thinking is disarmament, demobilization, reintegration. Is that concept applicable to northeastern Nigeria? Can we even think about those three concepts at this point, or is it too early?
Those concepts have been overtaken by time,
mm-hmm.
and the context itself in northeast Nigeria calls for a new approach to look at those issues.
Mm-hmm.
Following the World Humanitarian Summit in 2016, the world bodies agreed together to try to see how we can try to work on the humanitarian development nexus. That is trying to reach the needs of people, but also supporting people to work towards recovery and coping with the crisis. So within the Northeast Nigerian context, our primary focus is to try to bridge that nexus, humanitarian and development, which also call for a new way of working and a new way of doing business that is also calling on the international community to work on attitudes, institutional fatigues, and also joint funding opportunities so that we can bring synergies and comparative advantages to the table. Defection is a reality we are dealing with in Northeast Nigeria. There are some defections from Boko Haram taking place. The government is putting in place some rudimentary structures to start dealing with the defection. The civilian joint task forces are also in place to provide some security in some of the liberated areas. Definitely, in the short medium term, reintegration of that group will be extremely critical to be productive members of society and also contribute into the productive activities. The traditional demobilization concept, is elements of it can be applied within the Northeast situation, but not in the traditional sense we have been talking about. We are still trying to have a better understanding on defections that are taking place, care provided by the government of Nigeria, and efforts made in reintegrating these people defecting into civilian life. It is very much a dynamic process, and it's a learning process moving ahead. But what I have been advising the international community is that we cannot just take those traditional concepts and then apply them within the Northeast Nigeria. Demobilization happens within a different context and within a different framework. But here we are seeing defections, and they are trickling in. It is not of a formidable large number. But we know that if a form of a political process can accompany the ongoing military effort, there are so many people, boys and girls and women, who are currently caught in this vicious Boko Haram circumstance that don't really believe in that ideology, and would like to come back to normal life. I think that is the process that we need to initiate and then see whether we can influence in layers those people that don't believe in the ideologies, bring them back and try to work towards healing their traumas and bringing them back into societies to become productive members of society.
So you start with the defectors.
Correct.
And if the defectors can be reintegrated, and if there is some kind of political process involved, the hope is that the number of defections greatly increases.
Correct. That is the assumption. And that assumption is based on the practical realities that most of the people that are currently with Boko Haram have been forced over time to be with them, or some of them have been captured from their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And they are just being caught in this senseless war.
Can I just add that also people need to see a prospect for a future?
Yes.
And that's where the new way of working and the nexus between humanitarian and development is so important. And it's important that we bring that theory from the World Humanitarian Summit into action. Because we, in the case of the northeast of Nigeria, it's not about rebuilding or recovering. It is building something that never existed.
Yes.
It is bringing development to a part of the world who has been denied what many of us sees as basic human rights.
My understanding is that northeastern Nigeria is, in the best of times, one of the very poorest part of the Islamic world.
Not quite, because in the 60s, northeast Nigeria was a major, major trade route to the neighboring countries, and was also a breadbasket of Nigeria, producing a lot of cotton and a lot of grains. It is a rain-fed ecology, moving from that perspective, and they have some irrigated ecology around the Lake Chad, Lake Chad Basin, and then some irrigated agriculture that was put in place as an infrastructure. The root causes of the crisis, we have been able to identify are due to the prolonged development deficit. Development was not at the level that is expected to integrate the society into productive life activities. And then there were other deficits, human rights and governance deficits, that were quite weak. And then we had this acute poverty, because these people are subsistence farmers. They are virtually growing food to eat. Yes, they are not in the market economy moving ahead.
No, that's,
And then climate vulnerabilities, because most of them relied on the livelihood around the Lake Chad Basin, which is now dry.
Yes.
Because of climatic conditions in the area. So at the best of time, it was an area of some opportunity that declined very, very fast because of the lack of development investment in that part of the country.
The development deficit.
Correct.
Using the term in the broadest sense of the word, to include governance and human rights and so forth.
Correct. It was a major deficit that compounded to this situation we are dealing with. I don't personally see, I have not been able to conceive as of yet, a political motivation of Boko Haram. What I can see is an uprising from deprivation, which has been compounded by some religious factors over time. I mean, Boko Haram, it literally means Western education.
That's right.
It's not allowed in this place. So the level of education among boys and girls was very low. Mm-hmm. Although this area, Maiduguri, used to have one of the main universities in Nigeria, Maiduguri University.
It did indeed.
Yeah, but the citizens from that region itself, we are very few who were able to attend, to go as far as university. Mm-hmm. So you have a population that was not fully integrated in productive life. Some of them went as far as secondary schools level, and others never reached secondary school. And situation is even bad when you start looking at education of women and girls. They were disproportionately affected by the religious configurations that were taking place in northeast Nigeria.
And right now, our estimate says that there is about 1.6 million boys and girls that needs to go back to school in one way or another. And in the appeal that we are trying to mobilize the resources for, we are able to put 406,000 of those into school. But the rest, we can't really assist.
About a quarter of them you can assist.
Yeah, adding to this perspective of, yes, it's a short-term, alarming situation where we're at the brink of a famine. We shouldn't lose perspective of the medium to longer term. So while we are from the international community in close collaboration with federal and state authorities are distributing food, and we hope that the food pipeline will not break in July so we can sustain this operation, we are marrying this together with the work of, for instance, Food and Agriculture Organization from the UN, who in parallel to handing out food by WFP, World Food Program, is also trying to distribute seeds, tools, and fertilizers to these subsistence farmers. So they can now in May and June actually plant something in the ground that they hopefully will be able to harvest wherever it's feasible and possible due to the security to harvest something in September. Because if we don't do those short, medium-term investments in parallel to the hugely important life-saving operation, we are going to see an even worsening situation in 2018.
This is exactly what we have described as the nexus, trying to bridge the humanitarian and development effort moving ahead. And I think it's a concept that is very applicable to Northeast Nigeria. And it is, we are currently working with that strategic vision, and we are trying to work with that vision towards collective outcomes that can help us manage the international interventions in Northeast Nigeria. But I also want to emphasize at this point that development of this region will remain the responsibility of the government of Nigeria.
Yes.
And the international community is only there to help in the short term, but longer term development investment must come from the government of Nigeria.
Which means sustained attention by the government of Nigeria over the long term and sustained involvement by the international community in support of and assisting the primary actor, which is the government of Nigeria.
Correct. And this has been laid out in the Buhari plan that was launched last year that has tried to capture the strategic humanitarian recovery and development needs in Northeast Nigeria. And that Buhari plan was asking for over $7 billion as investment to pacify this area and also create a new opportunity and hope for people in this part of the world.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. It's been most illuminating, and I think our audience will also find it most illuminating. Thank you very much for coming.
Yeah, I also want to just point out the serious global security implication of the Boko Haram crisis.
Yes.
Because the government of the United States has been a key partner in fighting global terrorism.
Mm-hmm. It has.
Yeah. We, from the information we have, the Boko Haram group is now split into two.
Yes, we have the same information.
Yeah, the Shikawi factor, that is currently using the human bombs.
Yes.
Of children to bomb IDP camps,
women,
target military. And then we have another faction, we call it the Al-Banawi group.
Yes.
That is strategic and consolidating its base, but has direct link with the ISIS. So it's so critical that we stabilize this region, because if it is not done, then that whole stretch from Mali coming down will become a very, very convenient area for ISIS, as they are being pressured in Iraq, Syria, and Libya. And the cost of containing the terrorists in that part of Africa, Central and Sub-Saharan Africa, will be very, very costly. And the implications will be very, very high globally. We have all seen the crisis, the conflict in Syria, and the impact on migration. Nigeria is a populated country. Nigeria's stability is important globally and also important for the U.S. government in general.
It is indeed.
So our appeal is, it is too big to fail.
Yes, yes.
And in that context, we also strongly believe that Boko Haram needs to be defeated in order to work on a sustainable path in Northeast Nigeria. So the crisis has a global perspective that is critical and that needs attention. And that is why we think the three-pronged approach to support the government of Nigeria to address this crisis is very critical. One, continuation of the counterinsurgency and counterterrorism effort to ensure that Boko Haram is not able to control territories in Northeast Nigeria. But we are also cognizant of the fact that the nexus of counterinsurgency and counterterrorism has protection implications,
yes,
which we have already outlined. Two, we need critical resources to be able to sustain the scale-up that is currently ongoing. The risk exists that if we cannot sustain the current level of funding, the situation can relapse into a serious famine, which we have already outlined. The third approach is looking at the root causes of the crisis. Boko Haram did not just exist.
Didn't drop out of the sky.
Out of the sky, to be precise. It is due to prolonged development deficit, human rights governance deficit, acute poverty, and climate vulnerabilities of late. So it is so critical that the international community supports this with a three-pronged approach in order to address this crisis and bring hope to these communities that have been caught in this senseless war. So I think I would like to end on that note, highlighting the global terrorism that is linked to this crisis, which is very critical.
And that's the last word.